welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, we keep swimming with Pixar's Finding Dory. And in our second segment, we'll pull back to talk about voice acting and what it takes to bring a great sound without being seen. Plus, as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out the NPR One app for your phone for exclusive bonus content from NPR's hit podcast, Invisibilia. Find the brand new season of Invisibilia, stories from your local station, and more great podcasts on the NPR One app. It's in your app store now.
We've got animated fish and animated people on this week's show, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And we are very excited this week. We are bringing you a brand new fourth chair for us from New York, Daisy Rosario. Daisy, what do you do?
Well, I'm the senior producer for Latino USA, a weekly radio show and podcast, as well as the producer of an upcoming project with WNYC Studios called So Many White Guys, which
I haven't heard about this.
That's right. I was Daisy and I were both at an event this week at WNYC up in New York where the lovely Phoebe Robinson interviewed the also lovely Janet Mock for this upcoming So Many White Guys podcast. It was pretty cool.
Now, many white guys, there are four O's and so's?
Four or three. I've got to, you know, get on board with the style guide. But, Phoebe's the host, and she's talking to people that are actually not white guys.
So. Yep, it was pretty exciting. And if you listen to this show, you also may have heard Daisy do a little small batch with me about Gilmore Girls earlier this year. Are we still excited for that coming back?
Oh, man, I'm counting down. My mom keeps texting me about it.
Well, what we have on our schedule this week, first up, is Finding Dory. Finding Dory is the sequel to 2003's Finding Nemo, the Oscar-winning Finding Nemo from Pixar. And it brings back writer and director Andrew Stanton, plus voice cast members like Ellen DeGeneres and Albert Brooks. It adds new ones like Ed O'Neill, Ty Burrell, Diane Keaton, Idris Elba, Dominic West, and others. And in the first movie, you might remember Dory, the forgetful blue fish voiced by Ellen DeGeneres, helped Marlin, voiced by Albert Brooks, find his son Nemo. And in this one, Dory goes looking for her own family. Now, Daisy, you were one of the folks who told us that you were interested in Finding Dory. Were you a Finding Nemo person?
Oh, absolutely. I love that movie. I think it's beautiful and great storytelling. And I've had friends who've even said, oh, I like a lot of Pixar, but I never got into Finding Nemo. And I've made them watch it again and had them, you know, kind of upgrade their status feeling about it after they watched it again. So I just thought it was a beautifully well-told story.
Yeah. How did you like Finding Dory?
I liked it a lot, but not as much as the first movie. Though I will say that I did find myself at times thinking, man, I really hope that fish gets into that tank. Like, I was really emotionally invested, even though I also felt aware that I thought overall the movie was a little less sophisticated. The screenplay was, you know, making some choices that felt like they were just moving the plot along instead of maybe having quite as strong of storytelling as Pixar's done in the past.
Yeah. What do you think Finding Nemo had that this one doesn't have as much?
Well, there were some basic things, like the fact that in Finding Nemo, you have the whole ocean to go through. I feel like it just made it so the plot moved around easily. It never felt to me like they were just doing something for the sake of making the movie longer than 90 minutes. Whereas with this one, with the setting, it being in this, you know, Marine Life Institute, and there were times where they were just circling back to places that felt like they'd, you know, gotten themselves in a corner just a bit and knew that they needed the arc of the story to continue, but didn't really have any other place to put it. So they would circle back to something or repeat something. And, you know, so there just felt like there were these moments that were kind of simple plot devices, which I think Pixar in the past has really transcended that.
Yeah. How about you, Steve?
I felt somewhat the same way that Daisy did. I love Finding Nemo. I liked this movie. I think where this movie falls a little bit short is that the stakes feel a little bit lower. If you rewatch Finding Nemo, like that is a movie that is suffused with grief. There's a major loss at the beginning of Finding Nemo that sets the tone for a story that's a little bit darker and a little bit scarier. And really, you get a real feel for the amount of life and death stakes at the heart of it, in addition to this very warm and heartfelt and I think powerful story about parenthood and the responsibilities that parents feel. This movie feels a little lighter and it feels a little sillier. And I think that what Daisy said about taking it from the whole ocean to this very confined, kind of safe space makes it feel a little bit just lighter.
Yeah. How about you, Glenn?
Yeah, I mean, liked, didn't love. What did your daughter say, Stephen? 3 out of 5 stars?
Yes.
I'm pretty much there.
Yeah.
She's a sullen crank, but
yeah,
go ahead.
What this film lacks that Finding Nemo had, I think, is economy, is efficiency. There is a line in Finding Nemo where Dory says, "I look at you and I'm home." That is not just a lovely sentiment, that's perfectly efficient storytelling. There is so much packed into that one sentence that we don't need to be shown it because it's all there in the line. We don't need to insist upon it because it's all right there in the performance and in the line. They have made a conscious choice to treat her short-term memory loss from a joke, as it was in the first film, to more condition in this film. And it is the condition that makes her so wonderful, as her parents tell her. That's a good message to hear, right?
Yeah.
It's a good message for kids,
yeah.
But it does feel like
nice.
A message, right?
Yeah.
It feels like it's there. So I'm the only one around this table right now who has a degree in marine biology.
Yeah.
And I had some issues with the verisimilitude.
Oh, did you?
I didn't notice that at all in Finding Nemo, but in this movie, I just kept thinking, pick up on something Steven said, it feels sillier because the stunts in live-action film, we would call them stunts,
right.
Just seem so much bigger and literally unbelievable that I kept getting kicked out of the film because it just didn't seem.
And also,
you know, you can't just throw some tropical fish into a cold bay. That's not the way it works.
There's one point where a tropical fish goes into a jar of drinking water.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, you can't do that. I am not a marine biologist.
Right.
I felt that a few times.
Yeah. When I'm sitting in the theater and thinking, what of the isoclines? something's gone wrong. Probably with me.
Yeah.
maybe 20% of the film.
I was distracted too. I just didn't have a vocabulary for some of those moments. But absolutely, I found myself thinking there's a point where they're hopping via like water that spouts up.
Yes.
And I was like, well, this isn't in line with Marlin's character. Why would he let Nemo, you know, not breathe for that long?
Yeah.
I got stressed out by it.
I mean, I guess I would play the positive version of Devil's Advocate a little bit. And we talked about this actually with Stephen's daughter, the sullen crank, which is that one of the differences between Finding Nemo and Finding Dory is that Nemo is very much from the parent's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Finding Nemo, although it follows both the journey of Nemo and the journey of Marlin, is more focused on the grief and fear that the parent feels, the responsibility and all of that stuff. Finding Dory is more focused on the lost child trying to find her way back to the parent.
Yeah.
If you are a grown-up like we are, relatively speaking, I think you're maybe more likely to naturally gravitate toward the one that speaks more from the parent's point of view, because Sullen Crank Daughter was kind of saying you don't get very much of the parent's point of view in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting to know whether to a littler kid, the focus on what it feels like to be the lost child trying to make your way back to the parent, which in a way is a simpler, more elemental emotion,
mm-hmm.
might be just as satisfying in a way that maybe it's not just as satisfying to people who are either parents or peers of people who are parents.
Well, I think that an interesting jumping off point there, I get that. I get what you're saying. I think that by putting so much emphasis on Dory, and obviously it's right there in the title, this movie's going to be about Dory, there feels like there's so much less of Marlin. And by extension, that means there's so much less of Albert Brooks, who is such a wonderful voice actor. And we're going to talk more about voice actors later in this show. I felt like the interplay between the gravitas and worry of Marlin and the joy and stick-to-itiveness of Dory, that interplay is really even mm-hmm. in Finding Nemo. And this movie tilts that balance so far toward the Dory character. And I do think this movie adds some very appealing characters. I really love the Ed O'Neill octopus.
Yeah.
I did not place as Ed O'Neill for the whole, I was like, that sounds almost like Nick Offerman, but it's not.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't quite place the Ed O'Neill octopus. I liked having some new characters that they did some fresh things with.
Yeah. I think part of what appealed about it is I think this animated movie and a bunch of other animated movies have been trying to introduce themes around kids who are different.
Yeah.
And I think that this, but also I remember we talked about this in the context of Wreck-It Ralph, the context of some of the themes in Wreck-It Ralph, and that more and more you see in a lot of these animated movies, it's not just the idea of a child who's lost, but it's a child with some kind of different way of being or different way of looking at the world. And I think there is some resonance. And the interesting thing is they transition from, in Finding Nemo, he has the little baby Finn.
Right.
He has the little, what they refer to at one point in the movie as a gimpy Finn. He's a little baby Finn on one side, which is different, mm-hmm. right? But with Dory, it's much more pronounced as a theme that her parents spend a lot of time teaching her how to go out in the world and how to keep herself safe when she's by herself and how to ask for help and how to deal with kids who are mean to her because she's different. And so I do think the resonance that it takes on, maybe it has more of this and less of that kind of grief of difficult parenting, is that idea of introducing, you know, difference among kids as a specific challenge.
Yeah, there's a certain rule, I guess, with animation that the bigger you make these characters' eyes, the cuter they are. And the I think we might have hit peak.
With baby Dory.
I think it becomes a little unsettling,
yeah.
actually.
She's pretty much all eyeballs.
Yes, the cuteness is a little aggressive.
It's got the kind of sad eye paintings.
Exactly, a Keen painting. Exactly. Yeah. I think one of the things I was reacting to is that other Pixar sequels, Toy Story 2 and 3, felt like we were picking up on those characters and picking up on specifically the human kid in those three films at different points in his life. Mm-hmm. So it felt like that was a story. That was an arc. Here, this feels literally like an afterthought. Like, so
fish don't live very long.
Well, true. but just this idea.
That's dark, Thompson.
Yeah, yeah. This idea that she has to find her parents because suddenly she remembers her parents. It just didn't feel like organically like I needed to know. And what we got was the backstory on Just Keep Swimming. And was anybody clamoring for a backstory on her little catchphrase? I don't really. Aww. It just didn't seem.
I feel like that's okay. I feel like that's a little more than a catchphrase. And I think the part of this film I found very, very moving was where you get a sense of the why of that and where that came from. I wasn't necessarily clamoring for it, but I thought they did some very effective stuff with it.
Yeah, I felt like there were. What you were saying with just the characters, it just kind of feels like we're in a different place with them. We're not picking up. That was one thing that really, I would notice it throughout the movie, you know, particularly as we were saying, you know, we have a lot less Marlin. There's very little Nemo. And, you know, it's not that there has to be a lot of those, but we know those characters very well. And when we do visit them, it doesn't necessarily feel like they've learned very much from their previous adventure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like that's carried over at all. It feels like Marlin is starting from the same spot that he was in the last movie. And, you know, that's fine for a lot of movies. I think I do hold aspects of Pixar to a little higher regard. I would hope that they would play with that more. And the same with kind of the expanded world of characters in this movie. There were some that I liked very much. I felt like they were better defined in the first movie. Mm-hmm. And there was differences between them, whereas the humor of the other characters in the movie was a bit more similar here. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think back to Finding Nemo, they do a great balance of Marlin and Dory's adventure versus Nemo being in the tank with all mm-hmm. these different characters.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I thought about this movie after. I was thinking a lot about it last night and thinking, like, no, they've successfully balanced many, many characters before.
Right.
Yeah.
So why did this one feel a little bit more stiff in that, a little bit more limited in that, you know? I felt like I really noticed that a lot. I found myself thinking, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Fair point.
I agree with that. I mean, I think also that the addition of the characters, as you guys mentioned, the new characters we get in this film, there's some sea lions that are fun. There's a bird that's fun, a kind of wordless bird. Those animals know a hell of a lot about the logistics and procedures of this marine institute. They know schematics.
They really do.
They really know. They know what happens when you go into quarantine, when you come back of quarantine. They know about Cleveland. They have.
Shout out to Cleveland, by the way, as we tape this. Shout out to Cleveland for last night's
I mean, yeah, it's a movie with talking fish. I get that there's certain suspension.
I was going to say, what are you going for here, realism-wise, buddy?
It did veer a little into Cars for that.
Yeah.
In that way for me. And Cars to me is, you know, the Pixar movie that I can't with. So
no, me neither.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, though, to look at the sequels out of Pixar, right? That they're now kind of in this rhythm of they make an original and then they make a sequel. And it's interesting to me, the Toy Story sequels were so successful. Yep. Some of the other ones have been significantly less successful. Cars 2.
Monsters University.
Not as successful. This one, box office wise, was enormously successful. It was immediately, I think this weekend was the biggest animated film opening of all time, which is a big deal, right?
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
there's clearly lots of love for it. But it seems like creatively, this idea of like, not love has been a pretty common response. And I do want to touch, before we get off this topic, on the short.
Yes.
Which is called Piper. Daisy, reactions to Piper.
It's a very simple story, but the animation is just stunning. I mean, that opening shot is just water and sand and foam, which are notoriously things that are incredibly difficult to animate. That and hair. You know, that's what you always hear if you listen to extras and things like that. So just the initial shot, I was like, oh my goodness, that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple story. I've liked some of the other shorts more, but I visually could not help but be incredibly impressed.
Yeah, I had the same reaction. As soon as I saw the opening shots, I thought it's photorealistic about daylight in a way that I think is a little different from the way they've done it before. And I went poking around today and found, you know, some stuff about a new process for how they animated the feathers on these birds, which is also impressive. I think they're doing something different with the way that natural light looks. Yeah. And I haven't quite been able to nail down what it is. But it looked really different to me from the way that stuff that purportedly is taking place outside has looked in the past.
And that's part of the point of these shorts, right? That each one of these shorts is showing some sort, they're showcasing some sort of technological
advancement. Sometimes they're proof of concept for something that Pixar is working on.
Yeah, and it was, as you say, photorealistic in many ways because these were not stylized in the way that we think of as cartoons. So these birds looked like birds. They had black beady eyes that they didn't, that they were not baby Dory eyes.
Yeah.
And that it felt, there's an extra layer to it that it gets.
It could have actually fooled me. If I didn't know that I was sitting there ready to watch a Pixar movie and to expect a short, I would have believed that that was a shot of actual water.
There's not very much story in this one, but I will say, better than Lava.
That's where we're setting the bar now.
All right. Well, I will be curious to hear what those of you who saw Finding Dory this weekend, and I know you did because I read Box Office Mojo, what you thought of it and how you enjoyed it. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about voice acting. We touched on it in this segment. We're going to get a little deeper into that. So come right back.
We'd like to say a quick thank you and share a message from one of our sponsors, Lagunitas Brewing Company, which began on a kitchen stove in Northern California in 1993. From actually getting their beer into bottles and onto the streets, Lagunitas always looks to the future. Whether it's supporting local communities by turning beer into money for the cause, or simply fueling stories and songs with IPA and other fine ales, wherever you go, beer speaks, people mumble. Mumble along at Lagunitas.com.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about the new animated film Finding Dory. And of course, in Finding Dory, you have all kinds of voice actors, both experienced and perhaps new to some listeners and viewers. So we're going to talk a bit more about voice acting in this segment. Now, Stephen, you are a guy who I think of as a big fan of voice acting because of your deep attachment to cartoons.
Sure.
So can you talk to me a little about your fandom of voice actors?
Glenn mentioned in the first segment, he talked about economy, the economy of characterization and how a simple line can get so much across. I think when you talk about voice acting, you can get this incredible amount of character development can come through just in the almost like the existence of your voice. And, you know, we'll get into a whole thing about celebrity voice actors versus more workaday, full-time professional voice actors. But it's amazing how much can be accomplished by casting a certain person who just brings all of their own, I want to say baggage, but in a good way, mm-hmm. to a characterization. And I'm always fascinated by that, of like what a really great voice acting performance can do. I think there's a temptation to feel like you're just going into a studio and reading.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like impressions instead of acting.
Right.
But like, man, a voice actor who really acts, you get incredible, incredible work.
Yeah. How about you, Daisy?
I'm fascinated by voice actors. I studied acting when I was younger, so I have a few friends who have gone on to make a living as voice actors. And, you know, also in making radio on Latino USA, we deal a lot with translation at times.
Mm-hmm.
And so we will have people act things out in a way. And, you know, for that, obviously, it's a lot more conservative than when you're making a film. But
right.
really thinking about that need to convey the emotion in a voice and what they're doing. I can think of movies where the voice acting really got me. I mean, that was one thing about Finding Dory that, you know, for whatever I did think was maybe weaker about it, I thought the voice acting was stellar.
Yeah.
And so, you know, or I think of one of my favorite characters in the last few years, Rocket Raccoon. I loved Bradley mm-hmm. Cooper in mm-hmm. Guardians of the Galaxy as that character. And, you know, I never like to see this before, but I love it when you do get to see shots of them in the studio after,
mm-hmm.
and you really see how physical they are. I mean, there's a piece of paper in front of them, but their body is sometimes 2 feet in front of that with the hand motions,
yeah.
and they're in it. I mean, they really are acting, even though they're looking at a screen and it's just a microphone in front of them, and they are completely physically in it. It is so much more than just speaking or reading, and so I think for the great voice actors, obviously, that really comes across.
Yeah, I remember seeing a clip of Chris Pratt, I think, doing the stuff in the Lego movie.
Oh,
and
yeah.
really, he was physically full on into that. How about you, Glenn?
Well, I think there's two schools, probably more, but at least classically. You have the old school of the Mel Blanc, June Foray.
Right.
And I would put Billy West in this school
I'd
as well.
Billy West there. I'd put Maurice LaMarche there.
Maurice LaMarche,
of course. Tell people who Billy West is.
Billy West played many things, including Fry on Futurama.
Also Stimpy.
Stimpy, yep. of course. And Maurice LaMarche, Pinky and the Brain.
Pinky and the Brain and like 70 different characters on Futurama.
That's the thing. Yeah. These are people of 1,000 voices.
Right. Yeah.
And there is something breathless to that. I wouldn't call it needy or thirsty, but there's something, it's aggressive, it's active, put
but
it that
some
way.
Of the, there's some of this in like Harry Shearer, I think,
sure,
too.
Sure, absolutely.
And Azaria.
Yes.
Maybe somewhat less so, not as pronounced as the 1,000 voices, but a bunch of different.
Right.
But somebody who's called upon to make to be a lot of very different characters.
Right.
Right. And if you hear, I heard Billy West interviewed, I think, on Nerdist podcast a couple years back, and he is there in the room doing voices, doing many different voices, because that's, you know, that's how he entertains people.
Mm-hmm.
There is another school, and it really came along around the time of Batman the Animated Series, when those casting directors said, we're hiring actors for their voice.
Mm-hmm.
We're hiring actors for their performance.
Right.
We know who this character is, so let's find an actor to match them. That's different. That is much less aggressive in your face. For a while there, Saturday morning cartoons really kind of reached out at you because they had to distract you from your, because you were buzzed on, you know, breakfast cereal. Shows like Batman the Animated Series and those that followed them, they kind of hold back. The voice acting is more subtle. I'm thinking of people like James Urbaniak. I'm thinking of people like H. John Benjamin,
mm-hmm.
who have voices that you kind of lean into.
Yeah.
You have to come to them. They are not going to be waving jazz hands, vocal jazz hands. They're more supple.
You also have people who are strictly voice actors who do really like one great funny voice,
right.
that you yeah. want, you just want the thing that voice brings. And I mentioned this recently, I saw a panel of voice actors at Vulture Festival when we were there, and Maurice LaMarche was on the panel, and Carlos Alazraki, who's another man of many voices, was on there. And they also had John Roberts, who does the voice of Linda Belcher from Bob's Burgers. And John Roberts really has that one hilarious voice.
Right.
Which is kind of a Long Island housewife,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, Bobby, you know,
yeah.
and that's really the voice that he brings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that doing one thing incredibly well versus being able to do 75 very different things. Like, you would not hire John Roberts to be 14 different characters,
right.
on a show,
mm-hmm.
even though they do have him play a few different characters.
Right. Mm-hmm. Animated stuff and, you know, whether you're talking about cartoons or the kind of animation that Steven is talking about more, which is kind of stuff aimed at adults, has such an interesting emotional pull on people. And so much of that emotional pull, one thing that's happened is that as animated movies have kind of evolved into this multi-gazillion dollar blockbuster business and have kind of come to be released several each summer, you do get a lot of kind of celebrity, you know, we got a famous person to do this voice. And sometimes that works out really well. I would say Pratt in the Lego Movie, who I already mentioned, is one who I feel, you know, that just sounds, that sounds like him. He seems like a born voice actor because he's such a goofball. But I think there have been ones where, yeah, it's a famous person, but are they a great voice actor is always a different question.
I think you also get a certain amount of repetition of voice actors. How many major big budget animated movies come out each year? A bunch, right? How many of them star Bill Hader, Adam Sandler, Andy Samberg, or Will Forte?
Yeah, right. I do think it's fair also to go back and talk about something that we have mentioned a couple times on this show, which is the bit that Chris Rock did about voice acting on the Oscars a couple of years ago, where first of all, he talked about what an easy way to make money it is, in that you sit in a room and say a bunch of lines and then you make money. But he also talked about the fact, he said, you know, voice acting is this amazing thing where you can be anything. You can, you know, if you're this person, you can be a princess or a whatever. And it ends with, and if you're a black man, you can be a zebra or a donkey. And it is so interesting to realize how, even in voice acting, things that you would think, you know, this should free you up, right? Animation should free you up from some of those limitations, but yet people go in and still discover them.
Well, yeah, but how good are you guys at being able to identify a voice as soon as you hear it? I am very, very good at it. It is my mutant ability. I'm designing the costume even as we speak. But, you know, Ty Burrell has a very distinctive voice.
Yeah. And I didn't get that one during the movie.
But see, that's it. I mean, like, so for me, recognizing that character, you start to impute, you know, start to fill it in with what you know about that actor.
Yeah, right.
And so are you guys good at that? Can you do it?
It depends. I mean, part of it is that I have started to pick up the ubiquity enough where it's like, oh, yeah, that's going to be Idris Elba.
Yeah.
It's a heavy, usually playing like a ram of some kind.
Yeah,
like, oh, that'll probably be Idris Elba
with some sort of beautiful accent,
right?
Which, you know, because in this
accent,
let him use his own accent in this movie, which is always good.
I did want to bring up a subset of voice actors where you are hiring them to bring all the weight of their distinct persona.
Like James Earl Jones.
So James Earl Jones, Christopher Walken, Woody Allen in Ants, Patrick Warburton, who's such a fun voice actor, but you can't not identify him as Patrick Warburton, and he's always going to play Patrick Warburton-y characters.
Yep.
Absolutely.
That sometimes, like, that can be a double-edged sword of, like, Christopher Walken is only ever going to play Christopher
Walken.
That's
true.
Or I feel like they're telling me that they want me to feel a certain thing.
Exactly.
You know, once I hear Morgan Freeman, once I hear James Earl Jones, I'm like, okay, strap in. There's going to be an emotional arc here that we're really expecting any moment now.
Yeah, I think the Lego Movie did that on purpose, especially, like, with Morgan Freeman. That's sort of an in-joke that Morgan Freeman in that movie is very much signaling the, like, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Glenn.
No, it's nothing. It's just, you know, we had some tragic news this last weekend with Anton Yelchin's untimely death. That kid was 27 years old, went to look at his IMDb page, and it is huge. That's A. B, so much voiceover work.
Really?
So many animated work.
Wow.
Like, he was a clumsy Smurf, for example.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But there's a lot more. I mean, and so, you know, I guess that's a thing. Got lots of work as a voice actor.
I think there are a lot of people who, when they're coming up as young actors, if it's something that you know how to do. I mean, he was somebody that I knew, obviously, from the Star Trek movies, the new Star Trek movies, and also from a really lovely movie called Like Crazy that he was in that nobody saw with Felicity Jones, where they play a couple where one of them, they have a visa issue because she's British, I believe. But I do think it's something where a lot of actors, I think now a lot of actors kind of are able to kind of stay working in between projects that are bigger commitments because of the thing that, like Chris Rock said, you can kind of go in and do it, you know. Mm. I want to ask Daisy a little tiny bit more about this getting people to come in and do translation stuff.
Oh, sure.
What do you look for in a person to do that? Because obviously you want it to be unobtrusive.
Yes. And we try to be very thoughtful about when we're going to use narration versus just kind of telling you a little bit paraphrasing after the fact. So it just kind of depends a little bit on how much tape there is of a person speaking another language. You know, you're looking for somebody who is going to, I think, respect the emotion that the person is conveying. If we really do need to do a layover of a voiceover on that, I think we want them to kind of convey it without stepping on it, convey it without over-emoting it, or mm-hmm. without taking something away. One of the things that I absolutely love about getting to work in this medium is that you can hear people's emotions. And so when we're working on stories that have to feature voices that are in other languages, most of the time for us it's Spanish, but not always, sometimes we'll play it in the clear because you can hear that they're very emotive, even though you might not understand that what they're saying. And those are the instances in which we usually paraphrase. And then there are times where the emotion might be a bit more subtle, in part because it's a very serious story. I mean, we tell lots of very serious stories about migrants and people who are dying in the desert and mm-hmm. things like that. And you want to convey that properly and really pay respect to the fact that if they were speaking English, for the average listener, it would be something that they really understood.
Right.
But at the same time, we're not going to editorialize.
Right.
So in our writing around it, we can't over convey that emotion. So you're always looking for something that sounds about right. You know, I'll test it with other people in the room and mm-hmm. go, is this right? Does this feel like it's getting what we felt listening to the tape as people who could understand it naturally? You know, just finding that balance is key.
Yeah. And I think part of why this ties back into the kind of voice acting that we're talking about is it really exactly like you're saying. Even if you don't understand all of the literal words being spoken, in the voice and in the speech, there is all of this emotional content. Yeah. And so when you're talking about voice acting in animation or something else, that's sort of how you know how important that performance is that even when someone is not speaking a language that you understand, you get so much from just what you're hearing.
Right.
And that's true in kind of the work that you do and as well as in kind of traditional voice acting.
Well, and one thing that all this conjures up for me is just how much voice acting work there is in the world.
Oh,
like, we haven't even talked about video game mm-hmm. voices.
Oh, yeah.
There is
We got a couple peeps out there. Who do video game voice acting.
I have dear friends in New York. He's a screenwriter and she's a voice actor. So she was showing us trailers and playthroughs of her character in the video game Overwatch mm-hmm. and like reciting all these catchphrases and slogans as I can't quite remember the mm-hmm. exact thing, but she's having to do accents for it and everything.
She's
and then,
having to make effort noises.
She's having to make a lot of effort noises and just walking us through like how silly this process was, but also how incredibly time consuming to record for virtually any given situation what your character might say. And then she showed us a commercial that she had done the dubbed voice for an erectile dysfunction product.
Nice.
Where they had like a very attractive woman talking about the product, and they realized after they had shot the commercial that they didn't like the woman's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jen, my friend, had to perfectly match the breaths and mouth noises and everything. You would not know that it is Jen's voice coming out of this woman's mouth.
Yeah.
But there's even dubbing in live action.
Well, and there's what's the story? It's Tarzan, Legend of Greystoke. Is that the one that I'm thinking of?
Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes.
In which it was Andy McDowell in the movie, but they had the same thing. They didn't like her voice, and she is dubbed entirely throughout the movie by Glenn Close.
Wow. There is a hell of a lot of work out there for voice actors, and reading an audiobook is obviously
mm-hmm.
a very different thing, but there is a cottage industry of actors who have studios in their homes
mm-hmm. oh, yeah.
who record it and also cut it and then just send it to the publisher. So so being a writer and being able to do your own audiobook meant the publisher having to jump through different hoops
mm-hmm.
that they wouldn't normally do
because
it's such an automated process.
The point of this is, and I know that Daisy will back me up on this, the point is kids learn to do audio production.
Absolutely.
It opens all kinds of doors. Again, I would love to hear who your favorite voice actors are. Find us on Facebook, tweet us at PCHH. Let us know what you think. When we come back, it is going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo understands that you work hard to get the most out of life. From starting a business to saving for retirement, there are a lot of things you want to accomplish. Working together, Wells Fargo will take the time to understand what you're trying to achieve to help you reach your financial goals. That way you can care for the people and things that matter most. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/together. Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
I've got a few things. Linda alluded to it briefly. The Cleveland Cavaliers winning the NBA championship. Being originally born outside Cleveland, I feel a certain kinship with bedraggled sports fans who finally got to celebrate. Watching on TV a whole bunch of crying dudes was enormously satisfying. Much better to capture those crying dudes on camera when they're not being interviewed by people trying to make them cry.
Yes.
But that was, I
crying spontaneously.
Crying spontaneously. I found that to be a really sweet moment. Second of all, our friend Matt Thompson, who has been on this show before, he's now with The Atlantic. He wrote a piece that I really, really highly recommend about the Orlando shootings. Matt used to live in Orlando and is the gay son of immigrants. And he talks about that confluence of experiences. And with this incredible empathy, he writes a piece called To Be Outed in the Worst Possible Way. And it's a very heartfelt, kind, very understanding account of the tragedy from the perspective of somebody who's brushed up against some of the points that it revolves around. It's a beautiful piece. We love Matt. Highly recommend it. And finally, I got a chance to read some of James Joyce's Ulysses out loud as part of Bloomsday festivities. If you have never tried to read an impenetrable book that you've never read in front of a large crowd, right after the organizers announce that there will be free beer, it is a really interesting experience. When we do live shows for Pop Culture Happy Hour, we have wonderful, attentive crowds trying to read a work of literature when everyone in the room is talking at maximum volume is something that everyone who has ever had to perform live should try to battle a big crowd in that situation. It was kind of a weirdly wonderful experience.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, sir?
First, I want to echo Barry Hardiman on AMC's The Night Manager, the John le Carré adaptation. It stars Tom Hiddleston and Hugh Laurie. So MI6 is trying to infiltrate this gunrunner guy. So they use Tom Hiddleston as a guy to get in with him and go undercover, essentially. It's so stylish and so gorgeous to look at. I mean, Tom Hiddleston, I understand. I'm aware of his work. A little pointy for my tastes. But perfectly fine. And, an interesting performance. The other thing, last night's episode of a little show that nobody was really watching called Game of Thrones. Have you heard of it?
Heard of it, yes.
Was an epic battle, and something happened in it. Not going to spoil it, but something happened in it that has been needing to happen for at least two seasons. A character met his or her untimely end. Well, timely. Incredibly timely. Way over timely. And I'm writing about it a little bit for the blog. It was done in a satisfying way, but it just made me think about how watching this show as not a person who reads the books, it does feel like we're being led around by the nose. And in the case of this particular character, it really feels like it's just overdone. Yeah. Like they're making a point and they just keep making it. So the fact that this character is off of the table is a very good thing. So that made me happy.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Daisy Rosario, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I've also got a couple of things. So one is that Orange is the New Black is back on Netflix. I was looking forward to it. I found myself trying to get home early on Friday so I could get a couple of episodes in before falling asleep. So I'm not anywhere near done with this season, but I'm a few episodes in and I'm definitely already enjoying it. And, I think I'm always so pleasantly surprised when you start watching that show. And one of the very fun things about it is that you're going to get a backstory, but you never know which character you're going to get. You know, just a few minutes into each episode, it's kind of revealed, oh, today you're going to learn a little bit more about this person. And so the people we've learned a bit more about so far, I've found very satisfying. And then in addition to that, I'm kind of binging on documentaries right now, and I'm really fixated on the 30 for 30 series.
Yes.
And I know that there's more, but I'm living it through Netflix. They're all the old ones, maybe not every single one, but the majority of of the old ones are there. And so as everybody was getting ready to talk about this new season of them, I've been revisiting some old ones, which have been really fantastic. I love the one about Bo Jackson. Yep. If you do not know the story of Bo Jackson, please go watch it. He's just such a bizarre superhuman, and it makes so much sense that you heard about him a lot when he was younger and when you were younger, and then you didn't. It made me understand right. that in a way that I couldn't quite remember. And I also watched one that was called Believeland, which, you know, going into this week, I didn't realize how much it would end up meaning to me to watch that. But it's all about, you know, how hardcore the fans of Cleveland are and how they had been kind of stymied by this 52-year drought of a lack of championships. And I have to say, I was rooting for Golden State going into this series. And once it was tied up, I thought, you know, now that I know more about the people of Cleveland, I want them to get this one. Mm-hmm. And I found myself shouting. And it has nothing to do with LeBron at all. I just was genuinely like, I've seen the people of Cleveland yeah. in this documentary now, and I really want this for them. So
yeah.
to come back to that sports thing, it ended up making it so much more fun. And if you don't understand why people are so excited about this particular win, that will also give you a good way to understand it.
Yeah, and the people from 30 for 30 tweeted that they're in the process of putting a new ending on that. Documentary for future showings, which is
excellent.
Great. Yeah. Thank you very much, Daisy Rosario. Making me happy this week. The main thing I'm going to call out, I wrote about on the blog today, Monday, as we are taping this. It is a documentary that is premiering this week on HBO called Suited. Mm. And it is about a Brooklyn suiting shop, where they cater to transgender men and some transgender women and other gender nonconforming people, non-binary. And a lot of times when you have a documentary like this, it can feel a little bit generic. It can feel a little bit like now we will have a documentary where a bunch of people tell stories and it's kind of hard to get a specific angle on them. And what is so interesting about this movie is that through the lens of all these people needing a suit for an occasion and not really feeling comfortable with the kinds of suits that exist out in the world, they all come to this shop. There's a 12-year-old boy who needs a suit for his bar mitzvah. There is a guy who needs a suit for a wedding. There's a guy who's in law school who needs suits for interviews. And there's a specificity to it. Glenn and I both are Judge John Hodgman listeners, and he always says specificity mm-hmm. is the soul of narrative. Mm-hmm. And that's very true in this movie. You get a really particular way of intersecting with these people's lives at a moment that tells you a lot about not only, you know, life as a person whose gender identity and gender expression are perhaps, you know, not what people expect from you, but also kind of just what fashion and dressing and presentation mean to people. And it's produced by Jenny Connor and Lena Dunham from Girls and directed by a guy named Jason Benjamin, who has also, I believe, worked on Girls. I'm sure it's going to continue to run on HBO and probably be available on HBO Go. So again, look that up. It's called Suited. I liked it very, very much. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. Daisy, where do people follow you on Twitter?
They can find me at the handle at It's DMR, so ITSDMR, like my initials.
Thank you very much. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Invisibilia, NPR's podcast about the invisible forces that control human behavior, is back with a new season and a new third co-host. On this week's episode, Hanna Rosin travels to Louisiana to explore a very unusual oil rig, and Elise Spiegel takes us to the Soviet Union, where a popular American restaurant led to an unexpected cultural revolution. You can listen and subscribe to Invisibilia at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.